Are you tired of selling kidney for a laptop? Do you need to take notes in your family WhatsApp group without your boss thinking you're not working? Tired of explaining something when you could just draw it and share it? How about that backache? Is it heavy laptop related? Let the Mesa Fundi come to your rescue. Hashtag freedom with Fundi. Attach Microsoft Office for the ultimate experience. Make the shift and upgrade to the Mesa Fundi with Windows 10 Professional. The Mesa Fundi, flexibility reimagined. Available online and in store at all leading retailers. Mesa recommends Windows 10 Professional.
When life gets harder, you get smarter. You don't mission, you level up like a boss. Connect Vox Fibre to your home, starting from 554 Rand per month. Level up your experience with Airtime's Wi-Fi boosters, Vobi voice app calling, Office 365, and over 160 other products to enhance your lifestyle. Live smart. Level up with Vox. Visit vox.co.za to view our range. T's and C's apply.
This is Tech Central, and I'm Duncan MacLeod. I'm joined this afternoon on a call with Paresh Dyer, an expert on fintech and blockchain. Paresh, good to see you. Welcome to the show.
Great to be on your show. Thanks, Duncan.
Pleasure. You work in the blockchain space, but you have a lengthy career in financial services and fintech. In fact, you spent a decade in London working at various investment banks, I believe, and you were at Lehman Brothers when the financial crisis happened in 2008. That must have been quite an experience.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it always makes for a hot conversation topic, predominantly at a bar of a couple of whiskeys. In any case, you know, I moved to London in 2007, and my first job in London was actually at Lehman Brothers. Timing was apt, as you can imagine. Yes. It was probably about a year before the crash. So it was interesting. You know, we went through a crash, and the day that Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy was September 15, 2008. It's etched in my memory. It's a Monday morning. And prior to that, you know, a lot of companies were, you know, experiencing a lot of kind of downturn in their revenue streams. A lot of companies were being bailed out by the Federal Reserve. And the share price and the stock price of Lehman Brothers was crashing dramatically over the past couple of months, you know, prior to bankruptcy. However, you know, back at that time, a lot of the companies were being bailed out. So, you know, you would hear of this kind of notion of too big to fail. So companies like Wamu and, you know, Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae were being bailed out. Bear Stearns was being taken over by JP Morgan. So we went into the weekend of 13th and 14th of September 2008. And there was a huge meeting in New York, right? It was a Saturday and Sunday, and all the kings and titans of finance industry was there, right? I'm talking about Ben Bernanke, Henry Paulson, you know, Jamie Dimon, Lloyd Blankfein, you know, Alan Greenspan. These are titans of titans of the financial industry. So they went into lengthy discussions over this weekend, and you know, I can distinctly remember that weekend. I met up with a couple of my mates for a couple of pints in down the pub, and we weren't too concerned, right? You know, we thought that Treasury and the Federal Reserve would issue a bailout, or, you know, worst case scenario, we would have a merger and acquisition or some sort of takeover by, you know, one of the equivalent tier one investment banks. Mm. And then all hell broke loose, Duncan. Monday morning, woke up, looked at my phone. Chapter 11 bankruptcy, Lehman Brothers is down. So, you know, we walk into the office, nobody knows what's actually going on at that point in time. And as you can imagine, you know, if you remember some of the images, you recall people walking out with their boxes and, you know, walking out with Lehman Brothers signs. I was walking towards my office back at that time when those pictures were taken. It was an absolutely crazy time. Nobody knew what was actually going on. The turmoil has started, and that basically was literally the kind of straw that broke the camel's back and caused the entire recession. Yes. Back in 2008. Extremely testing time, tough time for people, you know, who especially were working for Lehman Brothers. Not, you know, and I don't think a lot of people actually know this, but, you know, Lehman Brothers was a tier one investment bank. You know, this investment bank was competing with the likes of Goldman Sachs, with, you know, Morgan Stanley, you know, Merrill Lynch, you know, Bank of America. So really, really, you know, large investment bank. So the repercussions of, you know, what happened for filing for bankruptcy really caused this entire kind of, you know, financial collapse. So quite an interesting time there.
Yeah, and Bitcoin kind of emerged on the back of that collapse, didn't it? When was the white paper released?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was in October 2008, and as you know, the anonymous figure known as Satoshi Nakamoto basically released that white paper, Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. And that was interesting because it was aptly timed, Duncan. So, in 2008, we really saw that financial collapse, that recession, was caused by the financial industry. I mean, it was really caused by defaults on lack of mortgage payments out in the U.S. and essentially all of these various different products that these banks were experimenting with and, basically selling off to other banks. So all of these acronym, financial products like MBSs, mortgage-backed securities, ABSs, asset-backed securities, CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, all of these very, very complex products that pretty much only a few people in the world could actually price. And these investment bankers were initiating, instigating these financial products, wrapping it up, tranching it up, and then selling it off. So this entire value chain of, debt was being passed on from one bank to the other. And that was essentially what actually caused the collapse of these various different investment banks and their positions to these kind of mortgage-backed securities. So essentially, the actual financial industry caused the collapse in 2008. And what I think, Duncan, is that a lot of people started to, come to the realization that the financial industry is not what it's made out to actually be. Mm-hmm. That trust that was given to the financial industry actually caused the recession, where people were losing their pension funds, people were losing their 401ks, people were losing their jobs. Pretty much exactly what we're seeing, at this point in time right now. We can talk about that a little bit later. But essentially, people had lost, kind of respect. They've lost that position that they've had within the financial industry and that trust within the financial industry. And so aptly timed, this white paper of Bitcoin actually emerged at that point in time in October 2008. And what that white paper actually detailed was a completely decentralized, distributed, peer-to-peer mechanism of sending currency, or peer-to-peer mechanism of sending bitcoins, right? And this white paper detailed that we don't actually require a central intermediary to actually facilitate financial interaction of value between people.
Satoshi actually made reference to the financial crisis in that white paper, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the actual first block of the Bitcoin blockchain, he referenced, I think it was the headline on the Financial Times, where the Chancellor of the UK was issuing a massive stimulus package and a bailout into the UK. So he actually imprinted that into the first block of the Bitcoin blockchain itself.
I remember that. That was fantastic.
Yeah, that's right. So essentially, we in 2008, October, we started seeing the emergence of this white paper, and slowly but surely we started seeing more kind of people started getting involved and starting to take notice of what a decentralized financial system actually is. And back at that time, I think it was it was very close-knit community that was actually interchanging kind of thoughts and coding and kind of development of the Bitcoin and the Bitcoin blockchain at that point in time. But we really started seeing emergence of this probably around, kind of 2010, 2011 time period. That's right.
That's when people started to actually notice it and started appearing in newspaper headlines.
Absolutely. So, back at that time, we were still, trying to deal with the aftermath of the financial recession. So me myself personally, I actually moved on to another company called Nomura, which is a Japanese investment bank. So back at that time, Barclays Capital bought over the North American business of Lehman Brothers, and Nomura bought over the European and Asian Pacific businesses of Lehman Brothers. So fortunately for me, I actually moved over to Nomura at that point in time. And then I spent a fair amount of time working at JP Morgan in London itself, predominantly within foreign exchange trading, kind of bridging the gap between business and technology, building out a lot of low latency, high frequency trading systems. And one key point there, actually, Duncan, is, just a key point is the actual wind down of Lehman Brothers took in excess of 10 years. right? So from the time it collapsed, 2008, I think the wind down only completed around 2018 or 2019. And back at that time, I actually had friends that were working for a company called Lehman Brothers in administration.
Right.
Guys that were, basically trying to unroll positions, wind up positions, having a look at, how do we extract data from various different systems. So, a lot of negative consequences coming out of that.
Do you think the financial industry learned from that crisis? Do you think that the necessary changes have been made through regulatory interventions, policy interventions, to prevent such a situation from occurring again?
Yeah, look, I think that the financial industry wanted to put, regulations, policies, procedures in place to alleviate some of those kind of cowboy tactics, as they call it, right, back in the day. And you would definitely see that, but I don't think we are anywhere close to where we actually should be. And we're seeing that right now, right? We're seeing that with the current financial crisis. And what this really reveals, Duncan, is the fragility of the current financial system. Right. I think that there was a little bit of reluctance from investment bankers post 2008 in terms of, inventing and playing around with very, very risky assets. But we really started seeing a lot of that come out and play again, around kind of 2015, 2016 again, where traditionally, really kind of ratings agencies and regulators and central banks should really be putting policies and procedures in place to alleviate all of this.
Yeah. Well, we're clearly in a crisis at the moment, very much unrelated to what happened in 2008. But we have this global pandemic known as COVID-19. We're seeing central banks around the world pumping huge amounts of liquidity into markets. Do you think that the current, we clearly have a global recession coming. Do you think this is going to expose perhaps some rogue players in the global financial system once again?
Yeah, look, I think it already has. And if we kind of contrast with the recession and the financial collapse in 2008 to what we're experiencing today, although, as I mentioned, in 2008, that collapse was predominantly caused by the financial system itself, whereas in contrast today, it's really been caused by the pandemic and the kind of, totalitarian kind of global state that we're kind of moving into at this point in time, right? But the actual consequences that we're seeing is exactly the same, right? Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, we're seeing the cracks in the financial system where the governments and the central banks are trying to, kind of alleviate and take pressure off where we currently are at this point in time. Now, if you have a look at the governments and central banks and the kind of mechanisms that they have in place to alleviate these issues, they only have very limited amount of levers that they can pull in these types of situations. And we see that in 2008, and we see that now in 2020, right? We see the massive amounts of money that's been printed into the economies under the disguise of, what they call quantitative easing. We see a lot of money being used for bailouts. Mm-hmm. However, what we're seeing right now, in contrast to 2008, is that there's a definitive lack of spending in the economy, right? So if you think about this, Duncan, these kind of stimulus packages tend to go out into the economy. The actual money is printed into the economy to stimulate people taking that money and purchasing, right? Going into the malls, purchasing clothes, putting more money onto their credit card, taking on more debt, as in buying more property or taking out a vehicle asset finance loan. Basically stimulating that particular economy. Now in 2020, where we are right now, people cannot do that, right? We're stuck at home. We're not spending any money. We're not taking on any more debt. So that printing of the money is having a very reduced effect within the actual financial system right now, right? And we see that even with the lowering of the interest rates. Yes. I mean, we see that in the U.S. at the moment. The U.S. is sitting on 0%. Now, generally speaking, when countries and sovereign states lower the interest rate, again, that stimulates going out into the market and buying things like property, for example. Mm-hmm. People cannot do that. We are sitting in lockdown. And that's why a lot of the money is now being used for potential bailouts. We haven't seen massive amounts of bailouts right now, but we've seen companies like, Lufthansa that's, going back to Germany and asking for a bailout. We've seen all of these airlines, which I think is really going to happen really, really soon. We're seeing things like, you know, helicopter deployments of money, you know, to actually, you know, give people a basic income for the next couple of months, right? And now we're starting to move into, you know, something what we call like universal basic income and more of a socialistic society. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as we've seen, there's a very limited amount of levers that central banks and governments can actually pull in these types of situations.
Talk me through quantitative easing. I've read a lot about QE and what the US government has done. The South African Reserve Bank recently introduced some measures to ensure more liquidity, I think, in the banking system. And they specifically came out and said, do not call this QE because it's not QE. Now, I'm no expert on this stuff. And I'm sure many of our listeners would love to get your view and an explanation of exactly what quantitative easing is. Is it, as I suspect it is, effectively money printing? And if it is, why is it not leading to inflation?
Sure. So look, essentially what it is it comes down to money printing, right? How it's actually done, that's done through the financial market. So typically what would happen is that Treasury would mandate you know, central banks to issue or to actually buy back various different financial instruments from the financial markets, right? And once they typically do that, they then push money into the financial system itself. Right. And essentially what that means is really printing money. So right now what the Fed has actually done is I think they're on target to kind of push in about $2 trillion worth of US dollars over the next couple of months into the economy. And as you know, this has a devastating effect on the power of people's money and what we call inflation. Right. So as you know, once you push more money into the economy, inflation skyrockets.
As
so
happened in Zimbabwe. Really,
absolutely, absolutely. We see the hyperinflation that happened in Zimbabwe. We see the hyperinflation that happened in Venezuela, right? And essentially that, I mean, worst case scenario is Venezuela. I mean, the devaluation of the currency would literally be about, you know, 10% within the day, intraday or overnight, for example. So what that would typically mean is, you know, if you were, you know, going to buy bread, your money is worth 10% less than it would be actually compared to yesterday. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's typically the actual consequence that inflation would actually have and money printing have within financial markets itself. I mean, if you just have a look at the actual power of the US dollar since, say, 1960 or 1970, maybe if we have a look at from 1971, where Richard Nixon actually debased or the US dollar away from a gold standard. Right. And you have a look at the actual power of the US dollar, and we see like this inverse hockey stick that literally goes all the way down. And that's really what erodes people's money, just printing and pumping money into the financial economy.
So I'm interested. In 2008, there was a massive amount of quantitative easing. It went on for a period of years. Yet American inflation didn't rise significantly. Why is that?
Yeah, look, you know, I think we can get some macroeconomists into the picture here, but you know, I think that inflation, as I mentioned, kind of erodes the actual power of the money that people actually have. Mm-hmm. There was an inflation measures, but what you would typically see is, you know, you would have things like budget deficits and moving around money, right? Mm-hmm. So you would have the selling off of US dollars into, say, the Middle East for oil, or the movement of dollars into China, for example. So I think that the foreign exchange markets were utilized fairly well to help alleviate some of the major effects of inflation that we were seeing in 2008 and, you know, subsequent from that for about 10 years into that.
Yeah. I had an interesting chat with Vinnie Lingham, who is the CEO of Civic, and a number you might have met him. He made some interesting remarks on a podcast I did with him recently, and I might be misquoting him, so perhaps go and have a look at the podcast. But he said something about the dollar being the world's reserve currency, and because of this, the dollar appreciated during that time of crisis. And because of that, America was able to ameliorate the potential inflationary effects of money printing.
Absolutely, 100%. And it's exactly what I was referring to, right? So the US dollar being the reserve currency of the world, I mean, we peg it to various different assets around the world, right? We peg it to oil, all of the minerals. You know, we even peg it to cryptocurrencies, for example.
Yeah.
And that gives it the power that it actually needs to kind of reduce some of these kinds of consequences.
Yeah. So America, in some ways, is in a fortunate position in that it perhaps has the ability to do that, whereas smaller economies like South Africa, those without large those that aren't considered hard currencies, if I can use that term, I mean, if we started money printing, we'd have an inflationary problem almost immediately.
Absolutely, absolutely, spot on. Look, and I think that, you know, we say that the U.S. is in a, you know, potentially privileged position at this point in time, but, you know, let's wait and see over the next couple of months. You know, as you know, we've just seen unemployment numbers come out. I think it was about last week or 2 weeks ago.
Shocking.
Absolutely shocking. You know, we're looking at, I think the number was about 3 million, something like that.
Yeah, 6 million, I think it went up to. I think it was 3 million. And then another 3, yeah.
100%. And that for me is, you know, we're going to see those consequences over the next couple of months. Mm. You know, defaulting on mortgages, on credit card payments, you know, lack of money being spent into the economy. And that's why, as I mentioned, you know, the US government is really looking at these kind of helicopter drops, as I mentioned, you know, universal basic income to help people get through this looming massive financial crisis that we're sitting on the precipice of right now.
And this is, I think I heard you say this is rather socialist. It seems that governments are shifting to the left to try and deal with this crisis. Is that the right thing to do?
Look, I really don't have any kind of answers to this. But you know, what we see is everyone's loves a capitalistic society until we get into this sort of recession. Right. And then we have nowhere to go. You know, we have to revert back into a socialistic society. And potentially even communistic. I mean, look at where we are in terms of, you know, imposing totalitarian sanctions on countries, on lockdowns, on movement, right? This is something that we've never seen globally, at least in my lifetime. And I think that we have to revert back into these kind of socialistic structures of, you know, UBI and, you know, helping people at the lower LSM, you know, of the population itself, who just cannot deal with what the repercussions of this financial kind of recession would be. So I think that, you know, capitalism is all great and well and great until the point that we actually hit this kind of position and we have to revert back into these types of societies.
Yeah, maybe we've become too used to the good times. I mean, throughout history, there have been boom and bust cycles. And in the capitalist system, recessions are part of that flow. We have a period of expansion followed by usually a brief period of contraction, and then generally a long period of expansion again. Certainly, that's been going on for decades. And those recessions actually can help because it helps clean up the economy. It makes companies more efficient. Sure, there are a lot of negative side effects. There are job losses. Mm. It hurts the poor. But I think it could be argued that recessions are an important part of the capitalist economy because it helps ensure an efficient functioning of the system. Am I talking nonsense here?
Look, I think you definitely answered something, right? It's almost a kind of cleanup that we have.
Exactly.
You know, when we go through this every kind of 10 to 15 years, you know, as we've seen. But, you know, I think we, you know, I don't really want to go into conspiracy theories here, but, you know, I think we under the kind of ruse or disguise of a, you know, free capitalistic society where, you know, what I think is that capitalism really kind of has positive and is very advantageous to a very small 1% subset of the people that are truly ruling this entire world, right? You know, we're talking about the CEOs of the major tech giants out there. We're talking about the CEOs of the you know, tier one investment banks and the people that I've named before, like, you know, your Lloyd Blankfeins and your Jamie Dimons and, you know, your kind of Alan Greenspans and all these types of guys. Those are the people that are really benefiting within a capitalistic society. So I think, you know, we under this disguise of a free and open economy, which is great because, you know, we tend to set, you know, where we actually want to go and, you know, things like, you know, earning our own incomes and spending our own money. But again, that sort of cleanup then needs to happen in a kind of socialistic way of movement within the global society.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see which model prevails because, you know, China's going through a lot of pain at the moment as well on the back of the COVID-19 situation. That economy was already slowing. We're seeing a global geopolitical war between America and China, which I don't think is going to show any signs of slowing despite what's happening at the moment. and the sort of global grab for influence. In many respects, I think it kind of, and I'm just kind of wrapping off the top of my head here, but it, in many respects, what we see now is kind of like the Cold War all over again, where there was a global fight for supremacy and influence, and you had two global giants. Back then, it was Russia and the U.S., trying to influence nations around the world. Now we see the fight between China and the U.S. and Africa is right in the middle of it. And these are almost diametrically opposing worldviews. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out in the long term and what our economies and our systems and ideologies look like 10, 20 years hence.
Absolutely. And just to kind of add into that, and, you know, once we get out of this, and we will get out of this pandemic, right? You know, I think as a global society, we will fight and get out of it. But what's interesting to actually see over the next kind of 12, 18, 24 months time is, you know, who actually benefits from this? Who actually benefited from this pandemic? Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, you see a lot of theories out there about, you know, manipulation of the virus itself due to this, you know, kind of loggerheads between US and China, and, you know, who's going to be the kind of powerhouse of the world economy going forward. And, you know, I think it's going to be an interesting play over the next 24 months to see mm-hmm. how the countries actually come out of this.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about what the impact of all of this is on cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin going forward. But before we get to that, let's go back a bit to the history. You were in London. You last worked at JP Morgan, and then you came back to South Africa. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I spent quite a bit of time at JP Morgan working in both sell side, which is the kind of global markets sales and trading space within foreign exchange trading, but also spent a bit of time on the buy side, which is asset management and portfolio management, kind of building out systems, sitting with the kind of traders in sales and, you know, kind of building out trading systems for them, predominantly within foreign exchange trading. What's interesting is that, you know, the actual majority of FX, traditional FX fiat flow, predominantly flows through the UK and through London. Yeah. So typically on a daily basis, you would have about, you know, 5 to 10 trillion US dollars worth of foreign exchange flow, and London would actually see most of that volume. So it was really, really great, you know, working mm-hmm. within foreign exchange trading. Mm-hmm. And that was in JP Morgan in London. And then we moved back to South Africa, where I joined a large financial banking institution here in SA.
Okay, and that's where you got involved with blockchain.
Yeah, so interestingly, you know, I started getting involved in blockchain and cryptocurrencies when I was living in London. Funny story is, I think it was back in about 2014, I wanted to buy a VPN service to, you know, kind of protect my identity and, mm-hmm. You know, not hide my tracks, but, you know, protect who I am online.
I mean, you weren't doing anything illegal, I'm sure.
absolutely. Disclaimer. And I went into one of the VPN sites, and I was just about to pay with my credit card, and I saw this little Bitcoin sign, exactly what you have behind you. Yeah. I saw this little Bitcoin sign on the website, and that was my first peek. You know, it piqued my interest into this, so I started clicking into it, and I could pay for my VPN service using Bitcoin. So I went on a peer-to-peer trading site in the UK, and I swapped my sterling fiat for a little bit of Bitcoin, and I paid for my VPN service then and there. And that was really what got me started within this industry. Mm-hmm. From that point on, you know, I started understanding what Bitcoin actually is, but also the underlying fundamental and foundational technology of blockchain. So I started getting involved in a lot of meetups in London, started going to the Bitcoin meetups, the Ethereum Classic meetups, and, you know, really, really started getting, you know, deep involved into understanding blockchain itself, but also, you know, what are some of these advantages and, you know, some of the, you know, kind of showcases that blockchain can actually have within a socioeconomic context, political, and a global context. So when I moved back to South Africa, I started getting really involved within the actual blockchain ecosystem within South Africa. So this was around, I would say around 2017, early 2017. Okay. And the blockchain space was fairly small. It was very, very close knit. There were a few people doing a few things within the space, a few consulting companies, you know, companies like Luno that were really up and coming, a few crypto exchanges, a few blockchain companies. So I really started getting deeply involved within the startup sector, within entrepreneurship sector, and basically trying to understand how do we start building a blockchain ecosystem within South Africa. Mm-hmm. Because as you know, Duncan, you know, blockchain is really a team sport, right? It's all about network effects. It's all about platform based. It's all about generating marketplaces. So, you know, we really need to form blockchain ecosystems, especially within South Africa, to try to unlock some of this opportunity that it really could have, not just within South Africa, but within Africa and emerging economies.
Okay. Do you think the blockchain is living up to its promise?
Yeah, look, you know, I think that if you have a look at the Gartner hype cycle, I'm sure that, you know, you and your audience would be very familiar with that.
Yeah.
You know, we kind of hit that kind of top end of the hype cycle, probably around, I would say around 2017, late 2017, early 2018, we really saw that kind of ICO boom, that initial coin offering boom in 2017. Then we started going down and, you know, we started hitting this kind of trough of disillusionment of blockchain itself, because I think that, you know, blockchain was being poised as this golden hammer that can solve anything and everything out there, right? Yes. And, you know, people were, you know, positioning it and, you know, raising silly money, you know, with initial coin offerings in 2017, taking investors' money, and then, you know, a lot of them were then running off and buying, you know, Lamborghinis and, you know, houses in, you know, huge houses in San Francisco or Nice or, you know, whatever it may be. So I think that there's been a lot of negative connotations around blockchain and cryptocurrencies since kind of 2017. But I think we're moving into a space right now is that, you know, a lot of, you know, innovators and disruptive innovators within the space understand truly or starting to understand truly where this technology could actually be used, right? Mm-hmm. Not for everything and anything, but in certain, you know, particular use cases. So, you know, things like, you know, supply chain management within trade finance, for example, or self-sovereign identity, obviously within fintech itself, within payments, etc. So I think that there are kind of niche segments and domains that blockchain is really, really geared towards. And that's really where we're actually moving towards right now. So I think we typically at the bottom of this kind of trough. And I hope over the next kind of, you know, one, two, 3 years, we start kind of moving up out into that and start actually, you know, tangibly building, you know, solutions, products and businesses that can really have a massive impact into the economy.
So there are real world examples in South Africa today of blockchain being used to solve real world problems.
Yeah, look, I think it's definitely out there, no doubt about that. I think it just hasn't been publicized as widely as possible as it really could be. Mm. You know, as I mentioned, a few of the use cases like supply chain management and trade finance, I think that there's a lot of consortia that have been formed with companies like, you know, IBM, Accenture, Microsoft, but together with the various different other participants like, you know, Maersk, DHL, ports authorities, customs authorities, etc., with projects like TradeLens and Voltron, Marco Polo, etc. Mm-hmm. Also within the self-sovereign identity space or digital identity, there's been a lot of traction happening out in, you know, Singapore, Estonia, Scandinavian countries, Canada, Switzerland, etc. But, you know, really, if we had to bring us back into the South African context, you know, I think that we are getting there. I don't think we are as mature as where we actually want to be in terms of comparison with these kind of shining beacons of Singapore, or Switzerland, or Canada. But we're putting measures in place in order to, you know, bring those businesses up to where we actually want to and help businesses and entrepreneurs actually grow. So there's a lot of good work being done in identity and cross-border payments, as we've seen with Project Corker being released with the South African Reserve Bank. I was very close to that project and it was a very successful project. So I think that they are successful showcases of blockchain within South Africa itself.
Yeah, yeah. Let's just go back for a moment for those watching or listening to this podcast. What exactly is a blockchain?
Sure. So a blockchain is really a distributed, decentralized, peer-to-peer network that's secured using cryptography, right? So it's quite a lengthy kind of sentence out there, right? So what blockchain actually means is it's a network that's been formed with multiple participants, which we actually call nodes, which then makes it decentralized, right? So if we kind of break that sentence up. So decentralized really means not having a single point of authority or a single point of failure, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't have a central intermediary, it's decentralized, okay? When we have a look at the word distributed, that network is completely distributed itself. So those nodes are sitting in various different places, either locally in South Africa or globally around the world, right? And then when we have a look at peer-to-peer, again, we go back into decentralization. There's no central intermediary. So exchange of value can happen on the peer-to-peer basis. So say between myself and you, Duncan.
Yes.
And then underlying everything is very, very cool and very, very complex mathematics called cryptography that really secures this entire network itself.
Okay.
So basically, that's really what a blockchain actually is. If you want to think about it in simpler terms, it really is just a distributed database. That's basically it.
Yeah, and it's a permanent record, and anyone has a view of the transactions that take place across that blockchain.
Absolutely, 100%. So some of the advantages of this is it's immutable, as you mentioned. So it's tamper-proof. Once a record has been stored within the blockchain itself, it cannot be amended, it cannot be deleted. It is completely transparent if you're looking at public blockchains versus kind of permission to private blockchains. Anyone can go and have a look at the various different transactions that are flowing through, say, the Bitcoin or the Ethereum blockchain itself.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, completely tamper-proof.
Right.
You know, the actual Bitcoin blockchain has not been hacked for the last kind of 10-plus years itself. That's right.
But it's,
many advantages.
It's also the reason that Bitcoin isn't truly anonymous.
Look, and exactly, that's right. And I think that, you know, people, you know, need to actually understand this is, you know, many people have been using Bitcoin as a privacy mechanism itself. It's actually pseudo-anonymous, right? So although your identity is being kind of denoted by your public key, which is used as a cryptographic measure itself, if anyone can actually pinpoint what their public key actually is, they can identify who you actually are, right? So it's pseudo-anonymous, but there are mechanisms in place, like utilizing various different keys for multiple transactions to alleviate some of those concerns, but it is not 100% anonymous itself, like how we would typically see in a Monero Zcash, for example.
Yes. Well, I was going to ask about Monero, because that is a privacy coin, and there are other privacy coins out there. How do they prevent people from seeing the transactions taking across going across their blockchains?
That's right. So they use mathematical constructs. Things like, I won't get too deep into this, but things like zero-knowledge proofs and bullet proofs and kind of range proofs to actually, hide the identity and make not just the identity, but the transaction anonymous itself, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So really what it uses is it uses things like, one-way encryption, right? So it encrypts certain elements of data one way, mm-hmm. where that encryption cannot be kind of reverse engineered itself, right? So it uses a lot more mathematical and cryptography constraints to actually shield identities and actually bring in things like, full confidentiality into those networks itself.
Okay, cool. So you left the bank that you were working for quite recently.
That's right, yep.
And you're now chief strategy officer at a company called Praxium.
It's Praxium, that's right.
What did they do?
Sure. So, Duncan, I think that we are in this wave of fourth industrial revolution. Right? What we call this 4IR, and really 4IR is categorized by this exponential rate of disruptive technology, right? And really, people when they talk about 4IR, they talk about technologies like robotics and artificial intelligence and blockchain, cryptocurrencies, IoTs, drones, etc. All those kinds of nifty kind of technologies, but these are really, really complex technologies, right? So when we talk about 4IR, for me, technology is the enabler of 4IR, right? And we need to understand what impact and what value proposition we want to build as businesses, as products, as product developers to utilize these technologies to have and deliver value to the global economy, right? So what we've seen as Praxium, Duncan, is really, we kind of seeing very, very complex technology infrastructure at the bottom. And then at the top, we're seeing, fintech founders, we're seeing corporates, we're seeing innovators that really want to make a huge impact within the global economy, but they don't really know how to go about doing that, right? So in essence, in the middle of those two layers, there's this chasm of, lack of understanding, a lot of complexity, a lot of cost, a lot of research and development, lack of talent as well, you know, understanding all of this. So Fraxium really fits into the middle of that, right? So Fraxium forms an abstraction layer, and it's an innovative launchpad platform to actually fuel fintech going forward, right? So it tries to alleviate a lot of the concerns and a lot of the myriad of challenges that I've just alluded to by actually providing a, you know, out of the box, ready-made fintech modules, but also in addition to that, enablement of what we call digital assets, right? So I'll just kind of segue a little bit into that, if you don't mind, Duncan. So, you know, I talk about this new financial system that we're currently building at the moment that's really being, you know, kind of being based on, you know, what we're initially seeing on cryptocurrencies, but also on blockchain itself, right? And for us, what we're seeing at the heart of that and the formation and foundation of that is what we call digital assets, right? Mm-hmm. But digital assets, as its name actually implies, is an asset that is digitally native and secured on a blockchain network using some sort of cryptography, right? Now, let me just explain myself a little bit more there. So a digital asset is an umbrella term that's actually being used. So it can actually encompass what we call cryptocurrencies today, for example. It could also encompass something what we call stable coins. We've been seeing stable coins. These are tokens that are released onto a blockchain that's been pegged to something like a USD or gold or whatever it may be. It could also encompass what we're seeing a central bank digital currency or CBDC. And again, we can unpack this a little bit later. And also it encompasses what we call tokens, right? So these are native tokens on a blockchain that could potentially represent a security token as an underlying value or an underlying asset on the native blockchain itself, or utility token, right? Some sort of utility that's being used within a financial product or network itself. So this is typically what we deem as digital assets that's going to be the foundation and the formation of a new financial system. And what Fraxium actually enables is very much out of the box enablement of digital assets. So allowing these businesses, these innovators to very quickly create digital assets, manage them, support them without having the complexity of underlying, you know, financial decentralized business models and complex technology infrastructure.
Okay, who typically would your clients be?
So typically we would be working with disruptive innovators, fintech businesses that are looking to deliver value in terms of things like cross-border payments or crowdfunding or issuing fractional ownership of financial assets. Mm-hmm. Like securities or bonds or commodities, for example, very innovative exchanges. You know, we're seeing competitors to the JSE that are very much interested in what tokenization, of traditional financial assets would look like on a blockchain and how we can facilitate unlocking of that entire value chain using digitization, right? Other potential clients would actually be potentially central banks itself. Right. You know, I think that a lot of central banks right now are looking at, you know, what I deemed as central bank digital currencies, a digital equivalent or digital representation of cash. And we, you know, we feel that blockchain is the underlying facilitator of that. So really what we're seeing is, clients in a wide variety of the fintech remit itself. And we currently, and I don't want to front run this right now, but we actually have two clients that are going to be launching on Fraxium platform at the end of this month or kind of early May. Mm-hmm. And we really see, really innovative companies coming out looking at, fractional ownership of assets, right? Mm-hmm. And I'll just give you a very quick example there, Duncan, just to kind of put it into perspective. The actual purchase of a property asset, for example, is out of the hands of the majority of the population that we see within Africa, right? And a lot of them are living on the breadline. Again, a lot of them are within that kind of lower LSM of the market itself. Yeah. Typically living on, $1 to $5, a day. Mm-hmm. And you would also see that with your domestic worker or your gardener, who really only has maybe 50 Rand or 100 Rand disposable income at the end of the month. Now, how can we enable those kind of unbanked or underbanked people access into the financial system? So something typically that we would really see is, can we develop products like a fractional ownership of a property or a fractional ownership of a title deed that would typically allow investors to invest at a minimum value of, you know, 10 Rand or 50 Rand into the upside potential in what that property value could actually be, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, this simplistic example also actually talks about the democratization of value into the public domain, right? So typically where we would have traditional assets that were only reserved for very wealthy or the kind of top, you know, kind of 1 to 5%, as in like, you know, IPOs or property or vehicles or, you know, whatever it actually may be, we are now seeing democratization of access to that asset or fractional ownership of this asset. And this is really what fraction actually enables.
Okay. All right. I know the Reserve Bank has spoken about a digital rand, and I must say I haven't followed it that closely. But you've engaged with the Reserve Bank quite closely in the recent past, and some of the initiatives that it's involved in. Just take us through what this digital rand is and how it might work.
Sure. So what we saw in the back end of 2017 is the South African Reserve Bank kicked off a unit within the division called the FinTech Unit, right? So the FinTech Unit was mandated to have a look at FinTech, financial technology, but with deeper understanding of what innovative disruption is actually going to have, is actually going to be over the next 5 to 10 years, what that impact is going to have to South Africa as a whole, and potentially what impact that could have to the financial system within South Africa. And the first project that we kicked off with the South African Reserve Bank FinTech Unit was something that we call Project Corka, right? Project Corka Phase 1. And that was early 2018. And really what Project Corka did was to have a look at whether we can tokenize the South African rand and facilitate wholesale domestic payments, right, in South Africa. Now, by wholesale domestic payments, I actually mean interbank payments. So mm-hmm. these are the payments that we would typically see between the big banks itself, right? These are not retail payments, right? So this is not a payment that I would make to you for 100 Rand, for example, right? These are massive payments that we would typically see kind of over the 10 million Rand threshold, even into the billions of Rands that mm-hmm. the banks would need to settle itself. Now, these settle, these financial payments, domestic interbank payments, clear and settle within the South African Reserve Bank, right? So essentially, the Reserve Bank is acting as a central intermediary mm-hmm. for the payments that happen between these banks, right? So what we look to actually do is, you know, whether we can have a decentralized distributed network that will facilitate the peer-to-peer payments between the actual domestic banks within South Africa on a peer-to-peer mechanism, so the South African Reserve Bank is not a central intermediary. Mm-hmm. Right, facilitating that payment itself. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. However, the South African Reserve Bank will still be an observer on the network itself. It will still have absolute complete oversight over what's happening within the network, all of the various different payments. So that was essentially Project Corka Phase 1 and what we kicked off. We built out that entire distributed network itself. It was an absolute success. And the South African Reserve Bank actually won, I think, best distributed ledger technology or best innovative project worldwide, right, as a central bank itself. Now that really kicked off some of the talks around, you know, what would a digital rand actually look like, right? So I alluded to this term of CBDC, right, central bank digital currency. Central bank digital currency has kind of two threads to it. One is wholesale payments, domestic wholesale payments, as I talked about in Project Corka. And the second one is retail, right? So this would be the retail payments that kind of you and me would actually make, right? That would settle on a nightly gross basis at the South African Reserve Bank. Now that is quite a complex challenge to actually solve. As you can imagine, the volume of throughput and the volume of transactions that are going through are extremely high. So the retail CBDC is what we actually call digital rand. Now, potentially, the South African Reserve Bank may be looking at it. They're not calling it a CBDC at this point in time. They have literally just released an expression of interest a couple of months ago to have a look at a call from various different providers to have a look at, can we complement cash in a digital format, mm-hmm. right? And that's really what they're currently looking at the moment. And one thing I just want to make a differentiation of is what we call a digital rand, right? Now, Duncan, we already have digital money, right? Mm-hmm. All of that money that you have and you're sitting in your bank account, when I pay you using EFT, that's all digital money, right? However, we've got to make a distinction between cash and digital money. So cash is actually issued by the central bank itself, right? So that is a liability on the balance sheet of the central bank.
Right.
Digital cash is actually issued by commercial banks, right? And that is formed, and that is a liability on the commercial bank, right? So that is formed by deposits and lending and issuing loans from this, from the commercial bank itself. Now, what we talk about for CBDC or digital rand is actually a digital equivalent of cash, right? So that would typically be issued by the central bank itself. That digital representation of the rand would be a liability on the central bank balance sheet. And that's really where the innovation actually is.
Okay, so it's a cash replacement.
That's right. That's right. Look, you know, in all honesty speaking, you know, if you had to compare where Africa and South Africa is compared to Sweden or China, right, which have really digitized and automated, you know, a lot of their sovereign fiat currency, we are nowhere there, Duncan. You know, Africa, cash is king, as you know that, right?
So I think cash because it's anonymous.
Right, exactly. And you know, even if they're not using cash for nefarious or illegal purposes, you know, people just want to transact in cash itself. When you go down to the spaza store, you go down to a flea market, for example, you know, cash is really king. So I think that, you know, the placement of cash into a digital representation is not about a tech conversation, right? We know that the tech works. We know that the underlying tech works.
Yeah.
It is really an understanding of, you know, how do we implement that monetary policy from a central bank perspective, utilizing that cash, which they could typically do in any case. But how do you get that digital representation of cash into the hands of people, right? And typically, and I generalize here, a lot of the people that are using cash would not have the means and the mechanisms, for example, a smartphone, to be able to have that cash and utilize it with the various different vendors and the mechanisms to actually transact with that digital cash. So I think that there are a lot of hurdles and challenges that we need to overcome in order to implement this. But if we don't go about actually doing this, we will never move forward as a society.
Yeah.
Now, one of the downsides of this is a lack of privacy, right?
Yes.
So once you have this digital representation of cash, you have complete tracking and ownership of where that cash is actually being used.
Yes, which I think could put off a lot of small retailers who perhaps out of the tax net right now. But it does raise some interesting questions. But I suppose the biggest challenge in moving to that sort of system would be a mindset change amongst consumers.
Absolutely, right? I think they'll be facing, you know, massive hurdles right now with this pandemic, with the recession that we're having at the moment, you know, with the lockdown. And I think that, you know, we're in a very kind of depressive society at the moment, right, with everything that's been going on. And again, you know, I reiterate, we will get out of this. We've got hard times that we're going to be facing. I think a lot of the startups and entrepreneurs that can make it through the next, you know, kind of 6, 12, 18 months are going to flourish after that. But one of the upsides that I'm seeing right now, Duncan, is are the startups that are really focusing on using and enabling disruptive innovation, right? And we see that a lot of people are starting to embrace digital, right? You know, with remote working, with transacting on their mobile phones, because they are forced to do that within the lockdown itself.
Yes.
So you're going to start seeing a lot of digitally savvy people emerging, you know, out of the pandemic itself, which definitely, you know, kind of promotes some of the fintech businesses that we see and that are going to, you know, kind of flourish as we get out of this. So, you know, fintechs are really focusing on, you know, digital assets in the payment space, in the identity space, are really, really going to have a good time coming out of this. And that for me is, you know, really some of the positivity that we need to focus on, you know, coming out of this pandemic.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, it's going to be the startups and entrepreneurs are going to drive this innovation rather than the big legacy organizations, if I can call them that.
Yeah, look, you know, as we've spoken about, I've spent the majority of my career working in corporate incumbents, and I think that they, you know, they move at a very slower pace because of the size that they've actually become, right? You know, some of these corporations and incumbents are 150, 200 years old, and over that time frame, they've built up, you know, legacy systems, procedures, governance, risks, etc. They really hinder that progress, you know.
Yes.
And that's really where startups are going to make an impact, because they can move agile, they can move lean, they can pivot when they actually need to, and they can get out to the market very, very quickly. And as you know, SMEs, startups, entrepreneurs are going to be the backbone of the economy startups are really, really going to fuel the economy going forward. It's not going to be the public sector. It's not going to be corporate. It's going to be entrepreneurs.
Paresh, unfortunately, we are running out of time, but I wanted to ask you a couple of final things before I let you go. You're involved in the launch of something called the National South African Blockchain Alliance. Tell us about that.
Sure. So that's SANBA, the South African National Blockchain Alliance. There's a lot of acronyms in this space there, Duncan. So, you know, I talked about, you know, building this kind of South African, blockchain ecosystem. And we need a lot more kind of push into the space. So the SANBA is really an alliance that's been formed it's a federated alliance. So it tends to tap into the various different blockchain ecosystem providers and bring them all together, right? So it is essentially an alliance that's been formed and being governed by the DSI. So that's the Department of Science and Innovation. And you know, we're very, very happy around government support around this. And the mandate has been issued to the Office of Digital Advantage, sitting in the CSIR, to basically run this. So myself and a few of my kind of colleagues within the blockchain space actually sit on what we call the consensus board, or the kind of consensus leadership forum. Okay. And we help actually drive some of these initiatives forward. We actually just launched the SANBA initiative at the back end of last week. People can go and have a look at it, sanba.co.za. And it's really to kind of, you know, catalyze, facilitate, and fuel blockchain ecosystem within South Africa, and also try to help, getting that kind of market aspect and getting that investment aspect, and basically tapping into this kind of blockchain ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So we're very excited about, utilizing this alliance as a catalyst to kind of fuel, innovation, not just within the fintech and the financial technology space, but also in other industries itself, like healthcare, for example, within South Africa, and then also tap into our colleagues that are sitting out, in African regions like Kenya, Nigeria, Rwanda, and Uganda. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And there's another startup that you're involved in called Blink, and under that is something called the Blockchain Entrepreneurs Club of South Africa.
Yeah, that's right. Again, acronym is BEXA, Blockchain Entrepreneurs Club of South Africa. So we essentially formed, Blink and BEXA again, to kind of bring this ecosystem together. And what we saw was there were a lot of pockets of fragmented innovation happening within South Africa. And people really wanted to understand what blockchain is going to mean for South Africa and learn a lot more with it. So Blockchain Entrepreneurs Club of South Africa, BEXA, really hosted a lot of events and information awareness sessions around South Africa. We've done quite a few events out in Johannesburg, in Cape Town, and in Durban. We've had the likes of quite good personalities like Vinny Lingam, who's a very good friend, when he's come down to South Africa.
Oh, so you do know Vinny, there we go.
yeah, that's right. Ricardo Spani, who's the lead maintainer for Monero.
Fluffy Pony.
Fluffy Pony, exactly, that's right. He's also very strong supporter of BEXA. So he's Luno and the various different other cryptocurrency exchanges and the various different other crypto kind of foundation. So we host information awareness sharing sessions in the actual formation of events itself to basically try to help people understand what this is going to mean, help them understand what they could utilize to fuel the economy itself, and to also start networking, right? And making those kind of contacts, making those alliances, and basically helping the public. That's right.
Yeah. Great, Paresh. I think we could have gone on for about 3 hours, but unfortunately we're bumping up against deadlines here, and I must let you go as well. But it was a great conversation. I'll get you back on the podcast at some time in the not too distant future, and we can continue the conversation and maybe get some updates on what's happening at the Reserve Bank, and also get an update on Fraxium. Sorry, I called it Praxium earlier. Fraxium. What's the website for Fraxium if people want to get some more information?
Perfect. Easy. Fraxium.com. Oh, and if anyone wants any information, please reach out to me. I'm on Twitter, I'm on LinkedIn, or email Paresh@Fraxium.com.
There we go. Chief Strategy Officer at Fraxium, Paresh Dayal. Thanks so much for talking to Tech Central today.
Great. Thanks very much for having me, Duncan. Appreciate it.